Well, welcome to Folk Tales. In the studio today, I have Paddy Ashdown, or to give him his right title, the Right Honourable the Lord Ashdown of Norton Southampton, Knight Grand Cross of the Order of St Michael, and various other things.
And so on. I mean, 2 points. The first is, Terry, that I don't use my title. I never do. I went to the Lords to get rid of it. I think it's a ridiculous, undemocratic institution, and it should be replaced by an elected second chamber. So naturally I don't use it, but bless you for doing so. And secondly, don't get too impressed by all these letters after my name. As we used to say in the military, they kind of come up with the rations of my lifetime in life, and I don't think people should pay them too seriously. Though obviously I'm very proud to be recognised by that. I don't think other people need to worry about them too much.
Okay. Is it all right to call you Paddy then?
Everybody calls me Paddy. Literally everybody. I mean, I wander around the streets of London, people come up to me and call me Paddy, and I find that actually rather flattering.
What indeed.
In a way.
Yes. But of course it's not Paddy, it's Jeremy John Durham Ashdown, born in 1941. The nickname Paddy stuck at Bedford School, I think, didn't it?
It did, but there's a sort of pre-story before the story. Forgive my dog. My dad was involved in all the great retreats of the last war, and he often used to joke about it. And he had a son after each one, and I'm Dunkirk. I'm the eldest. My second, my brother, is the retreat through Burma. So he was in charge of an Indian regiment who he led, without any loss actually, to the Dunkirk and got them out. They're never mentioned in the film, which I think is scandalous. So they were very perplexed by this, because I'm now born in Delhi, they're all back in India, and my Indian regiment turns up at my father's door and says, "Oh, Sahib, we have been fighting Germany. Why are you calling your first son Germany?" Jeremy. So anyway, here I am, a young Northern Irish lad with a broad Northern Ireland accent. At the age of 11, I'm sent to school in England, and of course I have a broad Northern Irish accent, and being English, people don't understand the difference between Northern and Southern Ireland, so they call me Paddy for good measure. And then when I joined the Royal Marines, many of my friends, 13 altogether, of us joined the Royal Marines with me, and the name Paddy carried across. And in truth, I'm comfortable with it.
Yes. Well, it's stuck around a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has stuck around a while.
As you say, you were born in New Delhi, and you were the eldest of seven, if I'm right?
Yes, I'm the eldest of seven, and there's only three of us left. And actually, that's been one of the sort of features of my life, the loss of my family in one way or the other. My parents emigrated when I was 18. My father ran out of money, emigrated to Australia with all my brothers and sisters. And my second brother, Richard, died at the age when I was four and him at the age of two. I lost a twin sister to a traffic accident in Melbourne. And my third brother, Robert, died of leukemia. So death seems to have sort of stalked the family. I've been very lucky so far, but death seems to have... I often thought my parents almost were, you know, driven mad by this consistent loss of their children. And it's been a sort of feature and fear in my life too. Mm-hmm.
As you mentioned, your father was an army officer.
It was Indian Army. And the family went out to India. They were part of the great soldier adventurers who went out to India in 1805. Conquered India and governed most of it. And my grandfather was the chief of police in the United Provinces, now Uttar Pradesh in India. And I came home in 1946. My father commanded the 14th Punjabi Regiment. And in due course, when the British left India after 150 years, he came home to Ireland.
And mother was?
Mum was a Northern Irish girl, the daughter of the auctioneer at a little town called Rathfryland on the hill in County Down under the Mourne Mountains. If you go into the Masonic Lodge, you still see my grandfather's picture there in Rathfryland. He looks like a sort of Saracen pirate, to be honest. And so they returned to Northern Ireland. Mum was a nurse, and that's how she met my father.
I see. You returned, as you say, to Northern Ireland, to Donaghadee in 1945.
45, 46, I can't remember exactly.
And late father 45. Had bought a pig farm.
No, he did buy a pig farm. When I returned, I was the age of, 5, 6, sent to the local primary school in Donaghadee. I can see it now. And when I went in there, they said, Dad's family's side of the family is Catholic, and Mum's side of the family is Protestant. And of course, I didn't know, we didn't discuss that kind of thing. And anyway, we didn't distinguish between the two. So I turn up to my prep school in in Donaghadee, and the first question I went, are you a Protestant or are you a Catholic? And I said, I went home and said, Dad, I'm not sure, am I a Protestant or a Catholic? And he said, go back and tell them you're a Muslim. So I went back and said, I'm a Muslim. And they said, well, are you a Protestant Muslim or are you a Catholic Muslim? So the Irish troubles and indeed the awful business of people slaughtering each other in the name of religion seems to have been introduced to me in India when the family was coming down and we passed through a station with which a huge massacre on it, the first of the partition riots, and then Northern Ireland, and then throughout my life is a sort of constant feature in it.
You went to local school, Bangor Prep School.
Yeah, a private school, yeah.
And then, as we've alluded to Bedford School.
Yeah. I wasn't very good at school, to be honest, Terry. I one of the reasons I'm wholly against the 11 plus is because I think, you know, some people are late developers and they develop at a different pace. I'm very clear if I took the 11 plus, I would have failed and then I'd have been cast into the outer darkness.
But Bedford School's certainly a decent establishment.
Oh, it's a very good school, but it was a fee-paying school. Yes, so you know, I didn't have to pass any exams to get into it and I was very fortunate. But what if I hadn't been so fortunate? What if my parents hadn't been able at that stage to send me there? Then I think that's what I think you need a second chance education system, and it comes very much for that. But back to my life, my parents then ran out of money at the age of 16. I mean, the pig farm, the farming business went bust. Sure. My dad was a wonderful man, but not a good businessman. I had to take a naval scholarship to pay for my schooling at the age of 16 to enable my brother to be able to go. And then my parents emigrated when I joined the Royal Marines, hence. The last 2 years wasn't a burden to my parents or my life, and that led me straight into the Royal Marines, which is part of the Royal Navy, which was a very good thing. At that stage, I loved school. I was had my ambition set alight, a love of poetry and music by a particular teacher, often the case with many of us. And I could have gone, I took the entrance exam to St. Catherine's, Cambridge, but my parents couldn't pay for it. So I went to the Royal Marines, and it was exactly the right thing for me. I would have wasted my time in drink and girls, I suspect, at university, instead of which a bit of self-discipline to the slightly rumbustious Irish young lad was no particular harm at all.
Sounds good. It's about time we took your first track, I think. Which one are we going to take?
You know, one of the joys, I mentioned it in my life, has been music and poetry, introduced to me almost in a single night by a remarkable teacher I had, who, by the way, died very close to Sherborne. He retired there. And he and my mum gave me a love of, he gave me a love of poetry, my mum gave me a love of classical music. And this was the piece of music that she introduced me to, which inspired me to open up this extraordinary treasure chest of classical music. And it's Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto. It's my mum's favourite piece of music, and it still makes me go a bit misty-eyed when I hear particularly the slow movement.
Okay, it's a slow movement of Piano Concerto No. 4 in G major by Beethoven, played here by the Vienna Symphony Orchestra.
Ah, good orchestra.
Thank you.
My guest today is Paddy Ashdown, and we've just been listening to some Beethoven. Paddy, we've got to the stage where you thought about going to university, decided not to.
No, my parents, it wasn't I decided not to, my parents couldn't afford me to go. But, I had no alternative, besides which, if I had gone to university instead of following through with the Royal Naval Scholarship, they'd have had to pay the money back, so it wasn't an option.
Okay.
But it was
the
right.
The Navy it was to be.
The Royal Marines, part of the Navy, of course.
Yep, sure.
And so I did my commando training down in Lymston, and at the age of 19 was posted to the Far East to join a commando unit, and we were involved in one or two small engagements, including the first Kuwait crisis. Most people don't remember the first Kuwait crisis. So here we are steaming up the Persian Gulf, being ordered by the government to get to Kuwait as fast as they can, as we can, 600 men on board. We're about to do an opposed landing against the then Iraqi dictator who was about to invade Kuwait. And I'll never forget it, 40 degrees of heat, and we're thundering up the Persian Gulf in the sunlight, getting there as fast as possible. And our colonel said, right, go ashore, and we'll take on these two Iraqi divisions, and that's 20,000 men. And we sort of looked around us, and we were, well, about 350, 400 men. And my colonel decided that in order to prepare us, he said, once we've got rid of these Arab Johnnies, he said, from Kuwait, he said, we'll put on a show, and I think we'll do a show of Scottish country dancing. And God only knows why, but very much part of the sort of last days of empire. So there I am thundering up the Persian Gulf on the quarterdeck of HMS Bulwark, preparing for action the following day, learning the eights and reel in an army kilt, in an army blanket for a kilt. It was utterly bizarre. Thank God when we got there before the Iraqis did, and we lined out in a thin red line on a place called Al-Mutla Ridge above Kuwait, and they never came, I'm very glad to say.
So you didn't have to perform the dance?
I didn't. No, I didn't. Then I came back home. That was the end of my training, and got married to my wife. We weren't allowed to get married. You were living in military sin if you were married below the age of 25, because officers weren't allowed to in those days. So we had no allowances, no assistance. I'm reposted back out this time to Singapore to join the commando, this time in charge of a commando troop. My wife manages to beg, borrow, or steal the money to get out and see. We're living off the smell of an oily rag, almost nothing. And we're sitting on the beach outside Changi Prison, the famous Changi Prison, on the 8th of December 1962. Somebody rushes up and said the rebels have taken over Brunei. So we had to bundle back to the camp, draw ammunition, morphine, and then say goodbye to our, very sort of colonial, say goodbye to our wives as dawn is rising in the officers' mess, jump on board a Hastings aircraft and fly out there to retake the towns that are taken by the rebels. We lost five Marines killed and five wounded. And that was the start of what was called confrontation, which was the little jungle war that went on for 2 or 3 years between Britain and Malaysia and Indonesia. And I lost some good friends in that. For the next 2 or 3 years were spent in jungle warfare, leading my troop in very isolated patches and learning the techniques of jungle warfare. And then finally, at the end of that, I'd become by this stage, I think, a sort of competent soldier. And so I decided I would try and go up the scale a bit. And I applied to join the Special Boat Service and went to Poole. Trained as an SBS operator, learned diving, parachuting, canoeing, all that kind of things, and Special Forces techniques. And then I'm posted back out again to Singapore, third time. This time with my wife, this time with kids. I'm 25, 26 now. And I'm in charge of number 2 special boat section at the end of this little conflict with them. And we worked off submarines and did strange things, which still I think I'm not probably allowed to talk about too much. And then, covering ground very quickly, I'd learnt languages by this stage, although at school they told me I was a disaster at language. I think I got a world record low mark in O-level French. But by this time I'd learnt Malay, and I was the only person in the commando brigade who could speak Malay, so I was sent up into the jungles to live with the Dayaks, and then I learnt Dayak. And so in my spare time as the commanding officer of number 2 Special Boat Service, Special Boat Sections they were called then, in the Far East, I decided I would go and teach myself Chinese and went off to a Chinese language school. I was the only non-Chinese there. The rest were all Hakka, Cantonese, trying to learn Mandarin. And I discovered I couldn't. It was a very difficult thing. I did reasonably, but I knew I couldn't do it. So I applied. I applied to go to take a two and a half year sabbatical and take an interpretership equivalent of a degree in Mandarin Chinese in Hong Kong.
Okay. Eventually, you decided to leave the Royal Marines.
Well, here I am in Hong Kong. I'm learning Chinese in the language school. A man from the Foreign Office comes along to me and says, "I say, I come to come out to lunch," and so I went out with him. And here I was recruited. He said, "We don't have too many people who speak Chinese and have got your kind of experience in the special forces. How about you joining us?" And so I joined a part of the Foreign Office. I'm not allowed to say what it was or I'd have to eat you and all your readers at the same time. Suffice it to say, I said yes. Before I could join the Foreign Office, so-called, I was returned to Britain and I commanded a company in my old home city of Belfast in the beginning of the Troubles in 1970. It was an interesting and very bruising experience since I was a Belfast lad and knew it well. And then I left and joined the Foreign Office, trained at a certain establishment which I can't name, and then posted to Geneva as a diplomat, in inverted quotes.
There's reference in the public domain that it was the Secret Intelligence Service.
You may speculate what it was in the public domain, but if I tell you, I will be locked up in the Tower of London.
Well, we best
will
not go that route, then.
Some cruel and unusual punishment, I suspect.
Anyway, okay.
I remember this, a little story for your readers, that at the time, the headquarters of this particular institution were not where they are now. There were 100 Westminster Bridge Road, a building called Century House. And although we weren't allowed to, we had to sort of sneak in without people noticing in case the Russians were watching. And I had to wear a false beard or anything, but we had to be discreet about it. We were slightly spoiled by the fact that the 159 bus, which I still catch every morning to Parliament, when it stopped outside Lambeth North Tube Station, the bus conductor used to always shout, "Lambeth North Tube Station, all spies alight here!"
Anyway, you ended up in Geneva.
I did.
As we say. And you were then first secretary to the UK mission to the UN in Geneva.
That was my title.
One point, certainly. But you didn't stay there a huge amount of time. You were involved in the Helsinki Accord.
Well, no, not in the Helsinki so much. I stayed there for 2.5 years. I'll tell you what, I mean, it was a fabulous time, Terry. We lived in a beautiful house on the lakes of, or the shores of Lake Geneva, a little boathouse, and a yacht. Kids were then old enough to go walking on the mountains in the summer and skiing in the winter. And it was a very interesting job, both the job, the day job, as it were, which was diplomacy, particularly in some of the UN institutions, taught me a lot. And the night job as well, which we've discussed. And here is the problem. The year is 1974, and my country is a mess. Two elections, three-day week. Who runs Britain? Is it the trade unions or is it the government of the day? And I was representing Britain and we were regarded as the sick man of Europe. And slowly over a period of time, by that time we were living in Yeovil, or outside Yeovil in Norton, where we still live, my wife and I decided that, you know, it was pointless living, even a wonderful life like this, an interesting life too, if your country was going to the dogs. So very naively, and it was the worst decision I ever took, but also the best decision I ever took, I decided to give that up and come back and go into politics to, you know, it sounds self-righteous, but to see what I could do to help. Nobody quite told me that my chance of getting elected in Yeovil, where the Tories had been in power since 1910, and they didn't count their majorities, they weighed it.
John Payton.
And a lovely man, John Payton. I had a lot of time for him, by the way. And so it took me 8 years to win the seat, two periods of unemployment. In fact, I at one stage, Jane and I were down to our last £100, and I am the only Member of Parliament, I think still, elected to the House of Commons from the unemployed register. I was a youth worker for Dorset County Council on what was called the Community Programme, which is an unemployment scheme. Everybody remembers Paddy Ashton, ex-Royal Marines, ex-SBS. Nobody remembers Paddy Ashton, ex-youth worker, ex-unemployed. But here's where I'm so lucky. None of this was done by planning. It just happened to me. But by the time I became a Member of Parliament at the age of 42, I'd been a soldier. I'd been a diplomat, I'd been whatever I was behind the diplomat, I'd been a businessman in Yeovil, I'd been unemployed twice, and I'd been a youth worker. And that turned out to be a fantastic apprenticeship to do my job. I think, getting serious for a second, one of our problems in politics today is far too many politicians have no experience of life whatsoever. It helped me a lot, and I wish others did the same thing.
My next bit,
just as my mum taught me, one of the things I think you do is you hand on to your children, I hope not in too Victorian a fashion, your culture, your values, and then they accept them or not. I got two wonderful children who are my best friends, by the way. I wasn't a very good dad. I think my wife really was the one who did well at that. I was a bit overly directive, I think. But my son is a passionate musician, needless to say, guitar music. My daughter loves classical music, as indeed my mother used to, very like my mum. And I introduced, just as my mum introduced me to classical music, so Beethoven's Fourth, I introduced her to classical music through this great Vivaldi, lovely, wonderful, joyful piece of music, Vivaldi Mandolin Concerto in G.
My guest today is Paddy Ashdown. Paddy, we've been talking about your early life and your career in the Royal Marines and other slightly unspecified things. You found yourself in a position where you came back to Yeovil in the sort of early mid-70s and decided to stand for Parliament. But as I was saying, you originally were a Labour supporter, but
I was, Terry. We're all allowed the follies of our youth. At the age of 18, I was a bit of a rebel. It was very unpopular in those days to be an officer in Her Majesty's service and be a Labour supporter. But these days there was the Labour Party of Shirley Williams, of Roy Jenkins,
David Owen,
Bill Rogers. Didn't get on so well with David Owen, but I loved Roy Jenkins and worked very closely with him when I was leader of the party. And I discovered that at that stage there were two men in my... I commanded 20 men to start with. Two of them couldn't read or write, and I thought this was an absolutely scandalous indictment on a nation. This is the year now is 1962, I suppose. And so I became a Labour supporter. I abandoned them in despair when, your listeners won't remember this, I'm sure, but when they had the Barbara Castle reforms to the trade union movements, which I very much agreed with, and those were kicked into touch, And it was plain to me that at that stage that the Labour Party would ever be the child of the trades union movement rather than, you know, having a wider representation. And I left. Then I was in the political wilderness until just about a few weeks before I go out to Geneva with the Foreign Office, somebody knocks on my door downstairs in this house, and they're a Liberal Democrat candidate, a canvasser. They had no chance at all. And I said, go away. And eventually he persuaded me to come and sit down. I said, okay, come and sit down. If you can persuade me I'm a Liberal, then I'll vote for you. And about an hour and a half later, I discovered that I'd been a Liberal all my life and took it down like an old coat hanging in the cupboard. And I've been very comfortable in it since.
So you stood for Yeovil originally in 1979.
Yeah, beaten by John Paton.
John Paton was the long-standing MP. And
we came from fourth, third to second, and that was the crucial thing, because now we were in a position to garner the Labour vote. I spent a huge amount of time working the states of Yeovil, and I loved it, adored it. It was what we call casework, and helping people with their problems, and that's, I think, where we built the strength to be able to move forward and win in 1983.
83, you won the election with a swing of 12% from the Conservatives in a year when the Conservatives were riding high.
Yes, it was a bit extraordinary. I'm told that this is, of course, post-Falklands, so the Conservatives were riding high, and that night, I'm told, I didn't see it myself. Mrs. Thatcher was asked on television, you know, did she ever think she, after she declared her victory, did she think she'd ever, she had lost? And she said, when I heard that the Liberals won Yeovil, I was worried. I was rather proud of that, especially since I was later to take her on face-to-face in the House of Commons as a young leader of the Lib Dems, and she was a formidable figure, and I greatly admire, even though I don't agree with her.
Yes, I mean, I was going to ask you, a lot of people who were on opposing sides to Margaret Thatcher nevertheless respected her greatly.
Oh, look, I mean, I'm a great believer in you stand up for your principles, and the sadness is I think that many on the left have become lazy, intellectually lazy, and she exposed that. I mean, I didn't agree with her. I think she was a great destroyer, a great puller down of the old things that needed to be pulled down, but she wasn't a builder, and I think we suffer still from having failed to put together a sort of culture in our politics which is inclusive. It's very divisive at the moment, even more so now. But I can tell you that there's nothing I have ever done in my life, or going forward a bit, than that has been so frightening than standing up as a young, wet-behind-the-ears leader of the then Liberal Democrats, taking on Mrs. Thatcher at the full plenitude of her powers in front of the television cameras of the nation and being smashed or handbagged, as we call it, week after week. It was deeply
fairly daunting prospect.
Very uncomfortable.
Okay, well, you became leader then in 1989, which was shortly after the merger of the parties.
Yeah, I'd only been in Parliament for 4 years, yes. And then David Steele stood aside and I fought for leadership and won it. At that stage, I often joke, but it's true, that the Lib Dems were represented in the opinion polls by an asterisk, denoting that no detectable support could be found for us anywhere in the land. It was after the absolute failure of the Liberal SDP alliance. And so, once again, I had to sort of pick my organisation up from the floor and try and rebuild it. And it was tough and difficult, but eventually, after 11 years and an election in 97, which we nearly doubled our number of seats, I stood aside.
The 1992 election was fairly benign, but the 1997
well,
one...
Well, 92 is very important because I said to the party, first of all, we must survive, and then we must do business. And 1992 proved that we could survive, because everybody said we were going to be completely wiped out, and we actually survived, and then we started to do business on the field of politics. Blair came along, he and I worked very closely together. We worked very closely together to remove John Major, a man I greatly love and admire, by the way, but I still see him a lot and have a huge amount of time for him. Very decent, decent man. Not a great Prime Minister, very decent man. And so we worked together, and the consequence of that was that we Lib Dems doubled our number of seats in 97 to more than 50, and Tony Blair, of course, got in with an astonishing majority.
Sure. And that period leading up to the 97 election, you were working quite closely with Tony Blair, or John Smith before him, I
believe.
Well,
not John Smith, no. I thought John Smith was leading the Labour Party in completely the wrong direction, and he and I didn't agree, though I admired him a lot. But certainly Blair, who had ideas which are very, very similar to mine. He used to say he was a Liberal, but he wasn't. I mean, he didn't place the same consideration that I do on human rights and above all on internationalism. He had a rather more, I suppose you'd say, imperialist view of the world than I do. But we worked closely together where we could. We even planned to have a coalition after the 97 election. So on the morning of the, whatever, May the 1st, I think, 1997, voting polling day, I'm in a school in Taunton, and he and I have agreed to talk. And phone call rings, I go into the headmaster's office, and we have a chat, and I said to him, "You're going to win with a big majority." "Yes, I am." He said, I don't believe it, but I think probably I am now. And I said, "You're going to win so big that I think there's a, you know, it's going to be a landslide." And what happened that day was that both of us, I was working with Roy Jenkins, we sat in my office in the Commons and we had another conversation with him on the telephone, and both of us concluded wrongly, I think, that the majority for him was so big that if we added our 50 seats to it, it would become overwhelming and therefore was a bit undemocratic and we ought to have added, we ought to stay. Anyway, it was the wrong decision in my view, and we spent the next 2 or 3 years beginning to try to recover that. The argument that we made, by the way, opposed in this case by some in my party, not everybody but some, and on his side by John Prescott chiefly, and Gordon Brown. But the argument that we made is if two parties who believe in broadly the same thing can have a coalition when it's not necessary, we did it from a position of the moral high ground out of choice. And I think that judgment was right, and I know that he believes, as I do, that we missed a real opportunity there.
Okay. Anyway, you decided not too long after that to stand down from the leadership in 1999.
What it took everybody by surprise.
Yeah, though. What led to that?
Well, very simply, I mean, I always said that I would much prefer to stand down when people say, "Why is he going?" and "Why isn't he going?" And I think one of the decisions you take in life is to know when you've done your best work. They often say of politics, by the way, I think also of leadership, that, you know, the people hang on too long and it all ends in tears and tragedy. You think of Mrs. Thatcher, of course, as an example. And I was determined not to do that. I was very clear that by 1999, after 11 years as leading the party, I had done my best work for them. I was getting a bit tired, a bit stale, a bit grumpy. And so I thought the time for me was for me to stand down when nobody expected it and hand over to Charles Kennedy. And indeed that happened in good order. And, you know, looking back, I think it's one of the best decisions of my life, because I had done my best work and it enabled me to go on and do the other things which I've done since. And how lucky am I that at that age, coming up 60 very nearly, I still have other things to do.
Let's take your next track. Which one would you like to take now?
I think, since we're moving on to it, a Sverdalinka. Let me explain. In the Balkans, the Sverdalinka is a class of music which is a Bosnian, chiefly Bosnian. And there's a lot of similarity between my old Irishness and the Bosnians and the Balkans. They sort of love sadness and melancholy. My wife always says that these songs are as though your heart has been torn out sideways. They're nearly always about love or about loss. The greatest of them is a wonderful song called Lijepa Amina. I learned Bosnian, by the way, as well before I went out to Bosnia. And Lijepa Amina is Beautiful Amina. And it's a song composed by somebody in Mostar watching a beautiful woman at the fountain. And anyway, here is not Lijepa Amina, but A Sverdalinka, which reminds me of my wonderful time in Bosnia.
Sawa
My guest today is Paddy Ashdown. If we can just deal with immediately what you did having left and then how you came.
Well, I remember that one of the things that sort of was a feature of my time as leader was the Balkan Wars. I just knew when they started in 1992 that these would be our generation's Spanish Civil War, both a predictor of the wars to come. And I also knew that, from my time as a soldier, that generals and politicians nearly always fight the last war, not the next one. And it was scandalous that we didn't intervene. And the reason we didn't was because we thought it was Vietnam, and I knew it wasn't. But part of my style of politics is to go there and see it for myself. So rather than sitting on the green benches of the House of Commons, I went into Sarajevo. Went into Sarajevo twice, went into Bosnia twice every year, once in the summer, once in the winter. Lived in the siege of Sarajevo, got to know it, got to understand it. And constantly, but they used to call me, the Labour Party used to call me a warmonger when I called for intervention, and many Tories used to call me the Member of Parliament for Sarajevo because I asked more Prime Minister's questions on the Balkan War than anything else. Anyway, the result was that finally the West decided they would intervene, the war was stopped, the Dayton Peace Agreement came along, and then in 2002, the High Representative, the International Committee's High Representative, invested with huge power by the Dayton Agreement, finished his term. Blair suggested to the European International Community leaders that I should do the job because of my interest. They said, "Is this guy up to it?" And Blair said, "Look, he's led the Liberal Democrats for 11 years, so the Balkans should be a doddle." And so Jane and I, my wife and I, went out there in 2002, and I was this thing called the long title, the International Committee's High Representative and European Union's Special Representative in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And we had four fabulous years. I learned Bosnian before I went there, tried to. We lived in a house above the city, modestly, and I did my best to try and use the authority I had, which was then intact because it was before the Iraq and Afghan war, to be able to build peace in a country I learned to love very much. And so Bosnia became part of my life as well, and I've been very lucky.
I'm slightly curious why the Balkans, rather than so many other hotspots around the world that you could have focused on?
Because it was the big event of the time. I mean, Rwanda was there too, because it was the big event of the time and because it was Europe. I mean, you know, we believed in 1945 that this would never happen again. And my first trip there to into Sarajevo and into some of the refugee camps, I actually saw men and women herded together, women and children largely, into cattle trucks and taken away by train to some of the death camps. So this was a repetition of what we'd seen in 1945, and I was very, very clear. I think it was Primo Levi who once said, "The whore is loose, the bitch is loose again," he said. In other words, the unbridled nationalism. And so it was on our doorstep. If ever there was or is an example of the kind of values we should have in Europe, it was the city of Sarajevo, where Bosnians, Croats, Muslims all lived in perfect harmony, and this was being destroyed. So it brought it home to me in a way which others wouldn't. But we should remember that the Balkan War was the main event of the time. The others, you know, weren't going on at that stage. No.
So you stayed over there for, I would say, 4 or 5 years?
4 years, altogether. And then you were... it's a very beautiful country. I would commend to your listeners, if you want a slightly out-of-the-way holiday, the centre of Bosnia, Sarajevo, is one of the most beautiful cities I've ever known. Wonderful setting. It's got a setting amongst the mountains which reminds me a bit of San Francisco, although obviously not without the sea. Beautiful, mate. It reminds you immediately of Switzerland. And it's a very wonderful walking. There are still primeval forests there, still bears, and glorious rivers. And I had a wonderful time there doing my job. It was quite a dangerous job, politically. I had four death threats out to me, but I don't think any of them were particularly serious. So I did a lot of walking, and I would commend it. I started the whole tourist business in Bosnia, which is now going a bomb. So if you want an activity holiday to see some of the most extraordinary sights of nature, but also some of the great cities like Sarajevo, which they often call the most eastern city of the West and the most western city of the East, really genuinely mixed together, this is the place to go to. You won't be bored.
And you were also, on a darker note, a witness at the trial of Slobodan Milosevic.
I've been to the Hague trial because I was out there during the wars and saw some of them close up and personal, including the Kosovo War. I went in with a KLA over the border as leader of the Lib Dems and was there when the Kosovo villages were being bombarded by the Serb artillery. It was quite an uncomfortable moment. And went to see Slobodan Milosevic afterwards and told him that this was a war crime under the Geneva Convention. My last words to him were, "I'll see you in The Hague," and I did. I gave evidence against that day, against him. I also gave evidence against two other war criminals in the Hague Tribunal. And so I've been back to The Hague several times. I was going to go on Karadzic and Mladic, but they had other witnesses and they had my written testimonies, I think. So now I'm off to The Hague in December for the close down of The Hague as it passes its duties over to the International Court of Justice. I'm a profound believer that in a very, very, very dangerous world, to have some laws and rules governing the business of conflict is crucially, crucially important for the future.
You were offered the post of UN ambassador to Afghanistan in 2008, but that one didn't appeal.
Well, so I just come back from Bosnia, pretty exhausted. My wife said to me, looked at me one day from the office, "Okay, enough of adventures now." But I'm out seeing my sister in Australia. The phone rings. We're sitting out having rather a nice meal under an Australia summer sky one night. The phone rings and it's Condoleezza Rice saying, "Would I go out and head up the international operation in Afghanistan?" That was followed by Gordon Brown, then the Prime Minister, also asking me if I'd go. The answer was I didn't want to because I was exhausted, but my wife and I thought about it all that night, actually. And eventually she got it right. She said to me, "Look, Paddy, I don't want you to go. You've done enough. But the truth is that young Marines don't have an option to not to go if they're told, and you can't either." So I agreed to go. We did 6 months of training, preparing for it, not training, and amongst which I met Karzai, President Karzai, on several occasions. I had a plan. I think it might have worked, but who knows. And then I think Karzai, he knew, President Karzai, I met him secretly in Kuwait, and he knew that my first priority, as it was in Bosnia, was going to be the rule of law. And this was the crucial thing we had to get because, in fact, the writ of the Taliban's law was running more than the writ of the government's law. And I was going to concentrate on rooting out corruption. I know that he was told by his friends that this wasn't a very good idea for business. And then they made it very obvious that they didn't want me to go. And, you know, it's a difficult enough job. I've always believed that the way that we impose these people like high representatives on individual countries is immoral and wrong. It's up to them. They have to agree to it. And Karzai made it very clear through government-controlled newspapers that they really didn't want me to do this. And so I rang Condoleezza Rice, who wanted me to go on, and I said, "No, if I'm opposed, it's a difficult enough job. If I'm opposed by the government of the day, then I can't do it." And it's very clear to me that it was because they knew I was going to tackle corruption.
Let's take your penultimate track.
There's a lot of Irish in me. I remember one of my school reports said, not a complimentary school report, I have to confess. Yes, Mr. Young Ashdown is excessively Irish, and it's right. So I'm easily moved to tears, and I'm easily moved to joy. And I love some of those Irish songs. And here's one of the greatest of them. It's called The Parting Glass, and it's by a Dubliner. And, you know, I think when it comes to my time to go, by the way, if it happened tomorrow afternoon, I would be pretty upset, I suppose, for my afternoon, but I'd have nothing to complain about given what I managed to cram into my life. This is the kind of song. It ought to be sung with a husky, smoke-filled throat, and it ought to be sung not with any sort of maudlin, but raucously, and they do. So here it is, The Parting Glass.
The Parting Glass by the Dubliners from 1968.
Of all the money that ever I had, I spent it in good company. And of all the harm that ever I done, alas, it was to none but me. And all I've done for want of wit, to memory now I can't recall. So fill to me the parting glass. Good night, and joy be with you all. Oh, of all the comrades that ever I had, they are sorry for my going away. And of all the sweethearts that ever I had, they would wish me one more day to stay. But since it falls unto my lot that I should rise and you should not, I gently rise and I softly call, good night and joy be with you all. Oh, if I had money enough to spend and leisure time to sit a while, there is a fair maid in this town that sorely has my heart beguiled. Her rosy cheeks and ruby lips, I own she has my heart in thrall. Then fill to me the parting glass, good night and joy be with you all.
My guest in the studio, well, actually in his home, is Paddy Ashdown, and we've been talking, Paddy, about your career, and we've got to the point where you didn't take the job in Afghanistan. So what's your current activities? You're just back from Hong Kong, I know.
I just sort of very full life. I was president of UNICEF at UK, but somebody else is now. So aside from that, I do a little bit of work to help people like Westland. I'm very involved in the Lib Dems. I'm chairman of the local branch. My wife keeps on saying to me, Paddy, this is the time in your lives when you pretend to be retired and I pretend to believe you. And I have sort of leftovers of my life coming back. So Bosnia takes up a good deal of my time. Things going bad there. Hong Kong too, since I learned Chinese. I'm very worried what the Chinese are doing to undermine the democratic process in Hong Kong. And I went out there to make a speech. Flew back yesterday. And the sustaining bit of my life, which you've managed to break into this morning, and I'm delighted that you have, is writing books. So I've always written. I'm now in my 10th book. It's an astonishing story. It's about the story, the books of history, by the way, not thrillers or novels. I can't do those. And this is going to be called A German Tragedy, and it is about the German opposition to Hitler in the Second World War, and it is an astonishing story. So I spent a lot of time doing that. Usually my books take me 2 years to research and a year to write. I've got a deadline coming up for Christmas, for the end of this year. So the moment we've finished, I shall be back down to see if I can get this done in time for my publisher.
And an autobiography in 2010.
Yeah, autobiography called A Fortunate Life, which covers much of this. And it's called A Fortunate Life, you know, Terry, because I can't say my life has benefited much from my correct decision making. I've made some very big mistakes in my time. I also can't say that I was sort of had a plan, and I certainly didn't have a silver spoon in my mouth, but I've been very lucky. I've been really, really lucky. If you think what I've been able to cram into my now 76, shortly 77 years, I look back and I really don't believe that, you know, people nowadays can live the kind of life that I've lived, and I'm extremely fortunate to have done it. So here is my last song. It's a song of ending, in a way. It was introduced to me by a friend of Strauss's four last songs, and this is the third of them. And it's about a couple standing on a beach, looking back over their life. And the last line is, Tiefen tausendfach zu leben. The last line is, you know, to have lived life a thousand times more fully. I was not long ago in the Eurostar, just been to Paris for a meeting, and I was rattling back across in the Eurostar, across the Somme, the battlefields of the Somme, and this was playing in my ear and on my headphones, and I found the tears rolling down my face, because I think combines, written by the way after the war when Strauss is 70 something or other, it combines, it seems to me, an immense capacity for living life and the terrible sadness, plangent sadness of sacrifice. And so if all the pieces of music I play, I think this is probably my favourite. Listen particularly to the way the violin comes off, the solo. This will be sung, I hope, by Elizabeth Schwarzkopf. There's a wonderful moment where the violin comes straight off, picks up the voice and soars up to heaven. So Streisand's the third of Streisand's four last songs.
Four songs. It's sung, as you say, by Elizabeth Schwarzkopf. It's the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra. Paddy Ashton, it's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Too.
And thank you very much
for doing it. Thank you very much indeed.